The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
O'Brien versus the United States was my stepfather, and Hoffa versus the United States was Hoffa. And it turned out that these were two somewhat obscure opinions from the 1960s that had, in fact, vindicated claims by Hoffa and O'Brien that the government, especially the O'Brien case, my stepfather, that the Justice Department had actually overstepped and engaged in unlawful surveillance. And this was something of a famous case back in the 60s. And I was amazed when I read it for so many different reasons, because it just brought a completely different part of my life, this stressful period when I was a young man, into the sixth floor of the Justice Department. And it also made me realize my stepfather, he had always told me about Justice Department malfeasance and how he had this famous case in the Supreme Court. I never believed him.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 5th, 2019. In 1975, labor union leader and American icon Jimmy Hoffa went missing. 44 years after Hoffa's disappearance, the crime remains one of America's greatest unsolved mysteries. One of those frequently considered a suspect in Hoffa's murder is Chuckie O'Brien, Hoffa's longtime right-hand man. O'Brien also happens to be the stepfather of Lawfare co-founder and Harvard Law professor Jack Goldsmith. In his new book, In Hoffa's Shadow, Goldsmith details his own rigorous investigation of Hoffa's disappearance and explains why the long-held assumption of Chuckie's role in Hoffa's death is misguided. Yet, the book is more than a murder mystery. In it, Goldsmith also reflects on the evolution of his own relationship with his stepfather. At the Texas Tribune Festival, Benjamin Wood has sat down with Goldsmith to discuss his new book, how he came to write it, and his relationship with Chuckie. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Episode 458, Jack Goldsmith on In Hoffa's Shadow.
So, Jack, I want to start with the opening anecdote of the book, which kind of connects the book to a lot of the themes that we work on at Lawfare. How did working on the Bush administration's warrantless wiretapping program bring you to reevaluate your relationship with your stepfather and launch a project that ended up with a book about whether or not he was involved in the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa?
Okay. Good question, Ben. Thanks for your kind words about the book. So before I tell the opening anecdote, my stepfather, the person who became my stepfather when I was 12 years old, 6 weeks before Jimmy Hoffa disappeared, is a man named Charles Chuckie O'Brien. And he adopted me the next year, but he became my father about 6 weeks before Hoffa disappeared. He was Hoffa's right-hand man and his closest aide for 20 years. He knew Hoffa since he was a boy. And since the first week of the disappearance, my stepfather was the leading suspect and the person that was thought to have picked up Hoffa and driven him to his killers. So I grew up in the Hoffa maelstrom, and that's the background to the event you asked me about, which is, flash forward almost 30 years later, and I am a senior official in the Justice Department, ahead of the Office of Legal Counsel. And I had been in the job about 3 months, and I was working on, as Ben says, President Bush's warrantless wiretapping program, which was full of legal problems. And it was an extremely stressful moment because I was trying to figure out whether the program could continue, whether it would have to be pulled back. It was deemed to be a very vital program at the time. The threat reports were off the radar screens like they hadn't been since 9/11. And so I was torn between trying to put this program on a sound or legal basis and worry that if it had to pull back, it was going to harm our effort in preventing terrorist events. And I was sitting in the Justice Department late one night, rather stressed out and tired, and I was reading, I had a stack of Fourth Amendment opinions on my desk because I was trying to learn about the Fourth Amendment. I actually wasn't an expert on the Fourth Amendment when I began this job. So to understand the program, I had to understand the Fourth Amendment, which is the main constitutional provision that governs surveillance in this country. And I was reading this opinion called Berger, a late 1960s opinion, and I was tired and reading these opinions and this opinion, and out came two citations, O'Brien versus United States and Hoffa versus United States. And I hadn't thought about my stepfather that much while I was there. I mean, he was always in the back of my mind. But O'Brien versus the United States was my stepfather, and Hoffa versus United States was Hoffa. And it turned out that these were two somewhat obscure opinions from the 1960s that had, in fact, vindicated claims by Hoffa and O'Brien that the government, especially the O'Brien case, my stepfather, that the Justice Department had actually overstepped and engaged in unlawful surveillance. And this was something of a famous case back in the 60s. And I was amazed when I read it for so many different reasons, because it just brought a completely different part of my life, this stressful period when I was a young man, into the sixth floor of the Justice Department. And it also made me realize my stepfather, who's, let's just say, has a very different outlook and educational background than I do, he had always told me about Justice Department malfeasance and how he had this famous case in the Supreme Court. I never believed him. It wasn't a famous case, but there was a case. So anyway, I stumbled onto this case. I stumbled onto, and it started me thinking down a process that led me to reconsider him. He and I had 20 years earlier, I had basically cut him out of my life 20 years earlier, mostly for selfish reasons. And it started a process that ended in this book, that was 15 years ago, but it ended in this book, and that's how the process started.
All right, so there's a lot in there, and yeah. Let's sort of unpack it. This was also around the time that we first met. And when you and I first met, as you describe, you had a very different attitude toward Chucky than you do now. And you had cut him out of your life. And I really remember it vividly when we first talked about Chucky. You described him as a really bad guy. I think the words you used were he was a mobbed up teamster. I don't think he was actually likely involved with the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa. And then you paused and said, because Jimmy Hoffa was basically his adopted dad, and he may have been his real father, but he was a really bad guy. And then you told me this story where when you had been a teenager, when you'd kind of acted up, he threw you up against a wall and said, I've killed guys for less than that. And you said, and I had no doubt that he meant it literally. So in the book, number one, you make clear that Jimmy Hoffa was not, in fact, his father.
Right.
You also...
I didn't know that when I started the book.
Right.
That took a lot of research.
So you also make clear that you actually idolized him as a teenager.
Yes.
And you were very close. And you paint him in this very loving way that does not... Yeah, he is a mobbed-up teamster guy, in fact. We'll get to that in a little while. But you paint him with enormous sympathy. And so I'm interested in the emotional trajectory on your part between being a kid who this guy marries your mom and becomes your kind of idol to your repudiation of him.
Yeah.
You changed your name to avoid his name, to this reconciliation that brings you back to this very warm relationship with him.
Great. So it happened in stages. I idolized him as a teenager. As I said, he came into my life when I was 12 years old. At that point, I had a stepfather and a biological father, neither of which were good fathers. They were, my biological father was quite a bad father. Never really had a male fatherly figure in my life. And Chucky, as I call him now, or sometimes I call him Pappy, that's another story. He came into my life at a time that was 6 weeks later, after they got married. It was the Hoffa disappearance just enveloped our life. But during all of that, he was just an extraordinary father. And he was an extraordinary father because he showered love on me and my brothers, love and attention. And he did everything with us, and he looked out for us, and he taught us right from wrong in a very serious way, even though he had trouble with it in his life. And I just lapped up the male attention and his strength and his love. My mom was very ill. So during my teenage years, I just thought he was the greatest person who ever lived, and I completely absorbed his values. I loved the Teamsters Union. I thought they were the greatest thing. And the mobsters that he was close to, who were my uncles, Uncle Tony Giacalone, Uncle Tony Provenzano, people that we used to hang out with, they were great guys. I mean, I really admired them and looked up to them, and I basically bought his story that mafia is kind of baloney. I wasn't sure if that was right or wrong, but I didn't worry about it. The government is this terrible thing that they're constantly breaking the law. And that was my worldview up through college. And it was the time during which we were very close. In college, I started to rethink all of this. I read some books about the Hoffa disappearance. It turned out that he had this violent and criminal past, which I hadn't really paid attention to or didn't know about. It turned out that a repo man came one day and sort of violently took my car that he had given me because he had not made payments on it, and that kind of scared me. I started thinking about my career. I got into Yale Law School. And I started to basically, the things I used to idolize, I became embarrassed about and afraid about. And then during law school, about several years later, I essentially completed this process of basically cutting him out of my life at a time when I was thinking, I want to work in Washington, I want to be a lawyer, I might want to work in the government. It's not going to be good for my career to be associated with these mobsters and my stepfather.
All right, but so that's a super harsh kind of retroactive self-critical.
Yeah.
If we had talked to Jack Goldsmith, Yale Law student, and everything is the fault of the Yale Law School ultimately, but if we had had the same conversation at the time you were changing your name, what was the version of it that you would have told then?
So I changed my name after college. And that was a very painful event for him. And I discussed that in the book, and we exchanged some amazing letters in retrospect. But here's how I was thinking about it at the time. At the time, especially when I was at Yale and studying law and thinking about my career, I told myself a little bit. Part of my thinking was, I have this trajectory and I don't want to be associated with him. I want to have my life and I don't want it to be harmed because of my association with him. But it was more than that. I also had convinced myself that he was a bad person. I had convinced myself that he had done criminal acts. I had convinced myself that he wasn't reliable. And these were true. He had done criminal acts. He wasn't reliable sometimes. And so I had just basically painted with a broad brush that he was a bad person and that I was justified in distancing myself from him.
All right. So now fast forward another 20 years, and we're back in the Justice Department in what I think I can safely say is probably the most professionally stressful situation you've ever dealt with, which is March of 2004. In a short space of time, you withdrew more OLC memos than probably a lot of the rest of OLC had ever withdrawn.
And to that point, yeah.
At least to that point. And you were being told that this would endanger the national security of the United States if you did this, and you did it anyway. And somehow this process causes you or triggers the beginning of a kind of revisitation of, and maybe a sense of guilt about how you had engaged with Chucky, causes a certain movement toward reconciliation. Yeah. Just tell us about that.
Yeah, a couple of things happened. A lot of things were happening at once. So it was a very stressful period. It was the most stressful period in my life by far. And it was a searing time. And I started to think about a lot of foundational things in my life. Chucky had always told me about inside the Justice Department how they had their own rules and how in enforcing the law, they sometimes cut corners in the law. And there I was, after looking at this opinion of his and thinking about this for 6 months, there I was knee-deep in exactly what he had described to me as a teenager, which I had dismissed at the time as, you know, the ramblings of basically a criminal guy who was trying to justify his life. I didn't believe him. And there I was living exactly in a very concrete way. It wasn't the same situation as he went through in the 50s and 60s, but living through what he had described, that led me to think, just basically think, well, maybe I didn't know as much as I thought I did when I renounced him. I started to realize here I was at the pinnacle of professional success, at least in the government, and I only got this job, I should add, because I had renounced him. I had very high-level security clearances, and it became very clear during my security clearance process when they figured out that my stepfather was the leading suspect in the Hoffa crime and that I had grown up with mobsters. That's not a great profile to get security clearance. And it was only because I had renounced him 20 years ago and had made that clear that I got these clearances. And there I had renounced him, and I got there only because I had renounced him. And then it turns out he was kind of right about several things. So that whole process caused me to rethink. I had recently had my first child, and then my second child, had two young children. And that, combined with these other things, more than anything, caused me to think and maybe realize how much pain I had caused him. My mother always told me that I caused him pain by cutting him out of my life. A letter he wrote me made clear that I caused him pain by cutting him out of my life, but I really didn't appreciate it until I had my own children and started to identify with how I would feel if my children did that to me. And I also started to recollect that which I had forgotten, which was how, what an extraordinary father he was at a time in my life when I was very vulnerable, and that I wouldn't have been where I was had it not been for him. So all of these things led me to, over the course of 2004, think about it, talk to my wife about it, and we reconciled at the end of that year.
So before we get to the meat of the question, which is, you know, did my stepdad kill Jimmy Hoffa? I want to talk about the portrayal in the book of the institution of the Justice Department and the institution of the FBI, which are kind of separate institutions and kind of one institution. This is a portrait that is just astonishingly rich and astonishingly mixed. On the one hand, the Bureau is engaged in all kinds of illegal activity, and this is, you know, the sort of heyday of the misconduct and in wiretapping and the like. On the other hand, some of the incredibly sympathetic people that you develop really deep relationships with, that is reflected in this book, are the FBI agents who conducted the early investigation of Chuckie O'Brien. And weirdly, he develops a kind of quite cordial and with some of them. So all of this happens after you've been a senior official at the Justice Department. There's one point where you're asking Jim Comey for advice. This is before he becomes FBI director, about how to interact. So how did you come away from this seeing the FBI and the Justice Department?
So that's a hard question. It's a great question. It's hard to answer because it's a complicated answer. I'll try not to take too long. Essentially, as you were talking about in the 50s and 60s, that was the height of, you talked about illegal wiretapping. Most of what I focus on in the book is not wiretapping, but bugging, the placement of microphones in a room. And this was a technique that was much more clearly unlawful than the wiretapping at the time. And it was in widespread use, and the government knew it was unlawful, and because it was secret, they kept doing it. And they did it a lot, in a lot of ways, that picked up Chuckie and his mother. And I have a chapter about what they learned and how really pretty awful in a concrete way this surveillance was. So that picture of the Justice Department in the 50s and 60s, prior to fundamental reforms in the 70s, is one that is extremely unattractive. And it's basically an example of, you know, self-servingness and legal interpretation and basically violating the law and getting away with it. And no one was really ever held accountable for that.
Wait, before you turn to the sort of more flattering side, I want to focus on one individual who you really spend some time on as a, I don't know, as a villain, but you really paint a very unflattering portrait of him, and that is Robert Kennedy, who, you know, a lot of people regard as a hero. In this story, he is extraordinarily unattractive and unappealing. So Before we go to the sort of more attractive side of the Justice Department, talk about Bobby Kennedy.
Sure. So Bobby Kennedy plays a large role in two chapters in the book. He plays a central role because he had an historic vendetta against Jimmy Hoffa. In the late 50s, when he was a young attorney working for a Senate committee that was looking into labor racketeering, he was the lead investigator. And The thing he was investigating, Jimmy Hoffa, the mob, and labor racketeering, there was a lot of horrible things going on, and they should have been investigating it. And Kennedy actually uncovered lots of really abusive activity and corruption in the Teamsters Union, including by Hoffa. But he also himself broke norms and laws in going after Hoffa in many ways. And he was very moralistic about it, and he was very moralistic, even though inside the government he was cutting corners. In many ways, more so as Attorney General, when he became Attorney General in his brother John's administration in the early 60s. But for 7 years, Kennedy hounded Hoffa, and he finally put him away at the end of those 7 years. And as I say, Hoffa had committed plenty of sins, and there was plenty to go after. But the way he went after Hoffa, both in the Senate and in as Attorney General, it was really one of the great examples of governmental overreach ever, despite Hoffa's sins.
All right, so now we're into the 70s, and the FBI is investigating. We'll get to the merits of the investigation, but talk about the agents who did this investigation and the U.S. Attorney's Office that supervised it.
So I actually spent a lot of time interviewing the four lead investigators of the Hoffa disappearance from 1975 is when Hoffa disappeared. And these four men were in their early 30s. They were kind of new in the FBI, and suddenly they were on, especially the two guys in Detroit, the biggest case ever. And I interviewed them for 7 years, and we became friends, actually, improbably. And they are four men who just have extraordinary integrity. They are the best I've ever seen. They are best exemplars I've ever seen from the department, in the sense that they still to this day care what happened. They're still committed to the truth. They're still, at the time and now, committed to following the right procedures, even in secret. And one of the things I talk about in the book is how the government was leaking stuff, either lies or a misleading way, to kind of try to pressure Chucky into talking about things. And these four guys did not do that. It's quite clear. And they followed the book. And so anyway, it was at least through those four men, it was really, for me, the best that the Bureau has ever, produced. They're just great men to this day. They're great men. And they had the biggest case ever dropped in their lap, and it was quite natural that they focused on Chucky.
All right, so let's talk about the disappearance and talk about how, and Chucky and the disappearance. So first of all, what was Chucky's relationship to Jimmy Hoffa, and why did the nature of that relationship cause the FBI to focus on him when Hoffa vanished?
So as I said earlier, Chucky, through his mother was very close to Hoffa and Hoffa's wife. Chucky, through his mother, met Hoffa when he was 9, and he was close to Hoffa growing up. And when he was a very young man, when Hoffa became president of the Teamsters in 1957, Chucky was 24 at the time, 23 at the time. He became basically Hoffa's, he had been his aide for a couple of years, but basically he became, his title was something like special assistant to the president of the Teamsters Union. And he was basically by Hoffa's side every day. And when he wasn't by Hoffa's side, he was in Detroit taking care of Hoffa's family. They were very close. Many people thought, because of their closeness and because of the affection that Hoffa showed towards Chucky, the extraordinary affection, even when Chucky was screwing up, Hoffa always protected him and always covered for him. Many people assumed that Hoffa was Chucky's real father. And Chucky treated him like a father, and he was, for all purposes, his effective father. Chucky's father left when he was 7 years old, about the same time that my father left. So they were extremely tight, and Chucky was basically his right-hand man up through the 70s. About 6 months, 7 months before the disappearance, they had a falling out for a whole bunch of reasons, complicated reasons that I talk about in the book. Part of it had to do with Chucky meeting my mother and wanting to start a new life. But they had a falling out about 6 or 7 months before the disappearance. So that's kind of the background to the disappearance. And when the disappearance happens, there's a whole slew of circumstantial evidence that pointed to Chucky as being in the area, driving a car in the area that was a car owned by the son of a mobster. There was Hoffa's scent was eventually found in the car. And there was a lot of circumstantial evidence that suggested that Chucky was the right person in the right time, and that Hoffa, because he knew Chucky so well, would have gotten in the car with Chucky. So there was some circumstantial evidence. There was this long-term intimacy followed by a breach with Hoffa. And also, Chucky was also, in addition to being very close to Hoffa, very close to the senior organized crime official in Detroit, who was the leading suspect in the case also. So because he was close to the leading suspect, and because he was in the area at the time, and because there was some evidence that the car had Hoffa in it, they naturally zeroed in on him.
All right, so let's talk about that other father figure for Chucky, Tony Giacalone.
Uncle Tony.
Uncle Tony. And why was it that Chucky, in addition to having this father figure in Jimmy Hoffa, had these very close relationships with very senior mobsters?
Basically, it happened because of his mother. So Chucky was born in Kansas City, and he was half Sicilian and half Irish, Sicilian on his mother's side. And his family on his Italian side in Kansas City was part of the early crime family in Kansas City. And Chucky, from a very young age, identified with his Sicilian heritage, and he basically identified with those values. He knew a lot of the old-timers, as he put it, in Kansas City. When his mother moved to Detroit, because her family had these connections, she immediately became known with organized crime in Detroit. And his mother became very close to, especially to Anthony Giacalone. And it was through his mother that he met Anthony Giacalone. Chucky's mother, just as an aside, Sylvia Pagano, is one of the most extraordinary characters in the book. And I wish I could have written a book about her, but I couldn't find any more information. She was basically the person who introduced Hoffa to the mob. And for years, she was a go-between between Hoffa and organized crime figures around the country. And she had really extraordinary influence over Hoffa, and it was seen to have that influence. And it's part of the reason, probably, that Hoffa was so close. There was also widely rumored that Hoffa had an affair with her, that's why Chucky is supposedly Hoffa's father. I think none of that is true. I try to show that in the book. But it's basically through his mother, who knew all these organized crime figures and was very close to them. Not just Anthony Giacalone, but Anthony Provenzano in New Jersey as well. That's how he got close to him.
So, an aside, but one that will amuse the audience. Mario Puzo has a character in The Godfather who is not a Sicilian and who he says specifically is modeled on Chucky O'Brien and his relationship with Jimmy Hoffa. And that is, of course, Tom Hayden, who's played in the movie by Robert Duvall. And so and Puzo has said that explicitly. You identify two other movies in which there are characters that are based on Chucky O'Brien.
Three now.
Because one came out this week, right? So tell us about Chucky's portrayal in the movies and to what extent any of the characters bear any resemblance to Chucky.
Good. So Puzo said that he based this Tom Hagen, soon after the book came out, he said he based the character Tom Hagen and this guy Chucky, this Irish kid named O'Brien, who was always at Hoffa's side, which he was always a few feet behind or at his side. That's the cover of the book. And it was seen in the 1960s, since Hoffa was a very famous guy and always in the news and always in pictures, and Chucky was always there with him, that he was like his consigliere. Chucky did not, in fact, have that relationship. He was very tight with Hoffa, but he wasn't his consigliere. He didn't have the skills of a consigliere. He wasn't... He didn't have great judgment all the time. He didn't really fully understand the business. So it was not an accurate. So I understand why Puzo thought that. They were very close. He was a half Irish, half Sicilian kid. But it wasn't a perfect model. Absence of Malice, involving Paul Newman, Sally Field. That was a story in which Paul Newman was explicitly based on Chucky, and that was basically a story written by Kurt Ledecky, who was the editor of the Detroit Free Press. He told me that the Paul Newman character was a composite character, but mostly based on Chucky. That was a story about a labor guy who woke up one day and saw himself framed in the newspapers, and it was about the government leaking on the guy to try to get him to talk about a crime that had just happened, to try to pressure him into talking. It was very much based on the way Chucky saw the world, and it's the way Ledecky saw the world. So Paul Newman, even though he doesn't look anything like Chucky, that was actually a fairly accurate portrayal in terms of the situation in his life. Danny DeVito played a character based on Chucky in the first Hoffa movie, And then Jesse Plemons, is that his name? Is rumored to play Chucky in the new movie, The Irishman, that premiered yesterday. So, and I don't know what that one says.
So,
it's really amazing.
No, it's really amazing to be played thing by Danny DeVito, yeah. Paul Newman, yeah. And Robert Duvall,
yeah, extraordinary.
Right? So, all right. Did he do it?
So the claim was that he picked up Hoffa from a restaurant in Detroit and took him to his killers. The claim was never that he knew that he was going to be killed, that he was kind of a dupe who was asked to pick him up and deliver him somewhere else. I always suspected that he didn't before I did 7 years of research, basically because he always spoke about Hoffa in reverential terms. And I just really didn't believe that he could have done it. After 7 years of research, I'm 99.9% convinced that he didn't. There are a whole bunch of, so the circumstantial case against him, I go through the book and very carefully show why none of that holds up. I give lots of reasons to think that he couldn't have been there that day, as the FBI said. And I give lots of circumstantial evidence on top of that for why he didn't do it. But for me, so there are a lot of reasons for me that convinced me that he didn't do it, including our conversations, hundreds of hours, thousands really, hours of conversation. But the clincher for me is that the Federal Bureau of Investigation basically doesn't think he did it either. And I learned that basically starting in the 90s, the Bureau, the agents in Detroit, for a whole bunch of reasons, similar to the ones I talk about in the book, and also some reasons that I didn't find on my own that I learned from them, they came to conclude that Chucky probably couldn't have been there at that time. There were independent reasons that they didn't think he did it, and they developed reasons to think someone else did it. So there's a whole bunch of... So I came to the conclusion that no, he didn't do it. And I think I make the case pretty compellingly in the book, which was, by the way, when I started this book, that was my main goal.
So, okay. So first of all, I agree you make the case very compellingly, but I also think the world is littered with books by interested parties saying,
yep,
my best friend so-and-so, who was long accused of blank, is innocent, and let me show that he couldn't have been there at the time, right?
So, and let me just say, that I was very aware of that in writing this book. It was a huge burden that I had to try to overcome.
Right, so I want to focus on your interactions with the Bureau and the U.S. Attorney's Office over it, because it seems to me that while one can raise that concern about you as an interested party, it is actually more interesting that their view of the matter has changed than that you, in reconciling with Chucky, have pored over the evidence and found that he didn't do it.
Right.
So when you said the FBI started to change its views in the 90s and has come to focus on a different person at this point, what do we know at this stage about what the FBI believes happened?
Okay, so I can talk about this a bit. I only talk about this for a paragraph in the book. I could have talked about it more. My publisher wanted me to talk about it more, but I decided not to. Basically, I learned from several agents and members, people in the U.S. Attorney's Office, this is something I had to piece together over the years through. I had lots of conversations with them in lots of different contexts in which they would say one thing and say another about who they really thought did it and why. I finally triangulated and figured out, and they basically acknowledged to me that was correct. The bottom line is the FBI, and I have not looked at their evidence, so I can't vouch for this theory. I can just report that this is what they believe. And I can only say that the bottom line is they think it was, even though the operation may have been authorized in New York or somewhere on the East Coast, that it was a purely Detroit operation, that the person they believed who picked up Hoffa that day in Detroit was a man named Vito Giacalone, who was the brother of Anthony Giacalone, who had also been close to Hoffa and also been involved in trying to get Hoffa to calm down and stop threatening to expose the mob's involvement in the Teamsters Union. They believe that Giacalone was the one that picked him up, and they believe that another person, the person they believe who killed him, was also a very low-level Detroit organized crime figure, made man, who soon after the disappearance rose in prominence in the Detroit family, and he died earlier this year. They seem very confident that he did it. They say it's based on surveillance information and informant information. I believe that their belief about that, and that was the killer, is the basis for the dig they did in 2013 looking for Hoffa's remains. They didn't find it. It was about the 12th or 13th dig they had over the 44 years looking for his remains. So as best I can tell, that's where the case is today, but I haven't seen the evidence. The FBI said a lot of things about my stepfather, the government, I should say, said a lot of things about my stepfather over the years, and they were confident he did it. So I don't have any independent way of confirming that that's actually what happened, but that's what I do believe, that they believe that.
All right, so mid-70s, Chucky's life is completely turned upside down by this. To this day, the U.S. federal government has never said he is no longer a suspect, and we're going to talk in a minute about your efforts to get them to do that. But before we do that, I want to ask about the impact on Chucky's life of being, like, what happens to you when the government decides that you're the principal suspect in the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa?
So, it's not a good thing. This was, for those of you who remember, this was a huge deal in the 70s. I mean, it was front page every day. It was a national sensation. It was a circus. And Chucky was in the center of the circus. And from the very beginning, he was named as a suspect. There was an affidavit by one of the Detroit agents, the one that I became very close with, one who actually told me for the book that he now doesn't think Chucky did it, who swore in 1975 that Hoffa was picked up and taken to his death by the car Chucky was driving. So the FBI from very early on made it clear that they thought he was a central suspect. They also leaked lots of information, some of their internal reports, some unattributed quotations saying, he did it, we have evidence, we're about to indict him over 25 years. It is not a great thing for it to be accused of that, especially since Hoffa was effectively his father. And it had a terrible impact on him, my mother, our family. It ended up basically ruining his reputation, obviously, ended up making it impossible for him to work in the Teamsters Union. So it had a devastating impact. And just to reiterate, they had good reasons for thinking he did it. They didn't need to leak false information like I showed that they did over the decades, the government. But they had good reasons for focusing on him in the beginning and for 20 years thereafter. But it was terrible to live through.
So one of the good reasons, or maybe the not good reason, but one of the big reasons they come to focus on him is that his essentially adoptive stepbrother, Jimmy Hoffa Jr., believes he did it, right? And Jimmy Hoffa Jr., who is to this day the president of the Teamsters Union, develops the idea that he had probably played a role and makes this argument to the FBI and deeply influences the way the FBI thinks about it. So talk about the role of Jimmy Hoffa Jr. In the development of this narrative.
So James Hoffa and Chucky had known each other since James was born. Chucky, in effect, helped to raise him because his father was always on the road, and Chucky was, and his wife and his family helped to raise the Hoffa children. But they were always rivals because James was the straight arrow. He went to Michigan Law School. He wasn't involved in his father's business directly, at least not the sinful side of his business. Chucky was the one who was close to Hoffa. Hoffa kept his son at a distance to keep him out of trouble. There was always a growing rivalry between them throughout the 60s and 70s. And this rivalry got more intense as Jimmy became closer to Hoffa and Chucky became less close in the lead up to the disappearance for a lot of reasons. So when the disappearance happens, James immediately concludes that Chucky was involved. And he concludes this because he calls around to ask where Chucky was that day. There was a gap of time that perfectly fits the time when Hoffa disappeared, where no one can account for Chucky's whereabouts. He knows that Hoffa and Chucky have had a falling out. And for whatever other reasons, he becomes convinced early on that Chucky was involved. They have a shouting match about it a couple of days after Hoffa disappears. And so when he talks to the FBI and gives him his first report about what he thinks happened and gives him his first lowdown on the case, he basically points the finger at Chucky and saying, I think he did it. He had all these reasons to do it. He was close to Jack Alony. He and my father had a falling out. He can't account for his time, and he's acting weird. And as I say, there were good reasons to focus on Chucky, but James's focus on him, the FBI agents told me, is what really led them to focus on Chucky. And so that's how it happened. That's how the focus on him began. again, they developed evidence to suggest that he might have been involved, but they basically glommed onto him in an intense way, first of all, because James pointed the finger at him.
All right, so as you start researching, as you develop these relationships with these FBI agents, you go back over this history, your instinctive doubts come to be reinforced by the FBI's own suspicions, and eventually...
But nobody, so just to be clear, nobody in the world knows this until this book comes out.
Right, right.
I mean, so this is all happening behind the scenes, and if I could just say something, this is one of the most troublesome things to me, is the government for 20 years leaks things and let it be known that he's the guy. This movie, the Scorsese movie, is based on the early FBI report, and I'm pretty sure I haven't seen the movie yet, but the book it's based on places Chucky in the car. So that's all the doing of the government who had to put out this theory, which everyone believes, and in the last 20 years, they've come to a different view, and nobody in the world knows it, so Chucky's left out there with this credible belief that he's the guy that did it.
And so you decide to try to broker an understanding between Chucky and the FBI where he will address their questions, take a polygraph if he needs, and they will issue a letter saying there is no, he's no longer a suspect. And so tell us the story of the near non-target letter or non-subject letter that you almost got from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Michigan.
So one of the themes in the book is how unlucky Chucky is. There was a review of the New York Times yesterday, a very nice review, where he said that Chucky has to be the unluckiest person ever associated with organized crime. And really, the book is just relentless about his relentless bad luck. You know, being in the area where Hoffa disappeared, if he didn't do it, being in the area where Hoffa disappeared, driving a car of the son of the guy who was the leading suspect, that's bad luck if you didn't do it. So actually, to clarify a little bit, the Bureau, starting in the 90s, the chief investigator, a man named Andrew Sluss, approached Chucky, starting in the 90s, and for many years said, I don't think you were involved. This was not really in the public realm. I don't think you were involved, and I'd like to clear your name. I need you to take a lie detector test. If you take the test and pass, we'll exonerate you publicly. So they started approaching him in the 90s. I found out about this in the 2012, basically. So I went to the FBI in Detroit and I said, is this offer still on the table? And tell me about why you think this. And they basically said, we don't think he did it. We think it was impossible for him to be there. And yes, we will send him a letter saying, you're not a target or subject and we don't think you did it. If you come in and do an interview, take a lie detector test. Chucky is very old. He's got severe diabetes. And he's not in great shape. He did this when he was 80 years old. 4 hours he spent there. It wasn't just this agent. It was the entire U.S. Attorney's Office. We had an official letter from the U.S. Attorney's Office promising this letter of exoneration. He goes through this grueling four-hour process. He tells the truth. They determine that he told the truth. And then they promised him that this letter would be forthcoming. Because they determined he told the truth, they didn't even require him to take a lie detector test. And in fact, they didn't let him take a lie detector test, it turned out, even though they promised him he would be able to do so to clear his name. And it turned out through a long and complicated set of events that they called us and they said, we're on the verge of giving him the letter. The letter's forthcoming. We just have to clear it with the FBI. And I couldn't believe it. I had spent many years at this point digging, trying to clear him, being convinced that didn't do it, that the stain of many decades was going to be lifted in an official way. And I'd finally allowed myself to be convinced that this letter was forthcoming because they told us it was forthcoming. And then the rug was pulled underneath him again. And it was pulled underneath him, I believe, according to the people I talked to, because that summer, a couple of months after this interview happened, that's when they did this last dig, and the dig looking for Hoffa's remains. And it turned out they didn't find his remains, and that was hugely embarrassing and very expensive for the Bureau. And after that happened, the political people in charge, I believe, in the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI agent in charge, it's pretty clear that even though everybody underneath them had promised this and they had signed off on it, and even though everyone underneath them believed that Chucky had told the truth and didn't do it, they basically decided, why are we going to give this letter of exoneration? It's just going to make us look terrible. And they stretched it out months and months and months, even though they promised it would happen in weeks. And 9 months after they promised, after we did this interview, they finally said, we're not going to give it to you. And they have no good reason for doing so.
All right, so I want to turn to the moral evaluation of Chucky, which one of the things I love about this book is that you clearly love the guy, and yet the moral evaluation is really complicated. Because at the end of the day, the exculpatory story is he was a mobbed up Teamster guy who did all kinds of things, that was involved in all kinds of stuff. His best friends are all mobsters. He's involved in some bad stuff. He was a great father, and he wasn't involved in the death of Jimmy Hoffa. But one of the really interesting things about it is that he clearly knew more about the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa than he was willing to tell anybody. And you get a chunk of it out of him.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, you don't get all of it out of him. And I don't want to spoil the ending of the book, but Chucky is pretty true to the Omerta code.
Yes.
And so I want to break this into two different areas. One is, how should we understand somebody who is, you know, part mobster, part union official, part bodyguard for a kind of corrupt labor union genius, really? I mean, Hoffa was a very impressive individual, quite apart from the sort of Omerta stuff, which we'll come to in a minute. How should we understand the career of Chucky O'Brien?
It's a difficult question. So I just need to say a word about Omerta to answer that. I mean, this commitment to not talking about things you're not supposed to talk about, to the code of silence, it's no exaggeration to say that it ordered Chucky's life. It was the ordering principle of his life, despite that was the ordering principle of his life and his love for me and my brothers. I really think those were, and my mom, those were the two ordering principles of his life in the last 45 years. And before that, with Omerta. And it's impossible for me to exaggerate, and I talk about the origins of this, why he first thought this and why it was important to him. Very early on, he makes clear to me, there are some things I'm not going to tell you. I can't talk about it. A lot of the dialogue in the book is about us skirmishing over what he can and can't tell me, and him telling me things he wasn't quite supposed to, and me trying to know where the line is. So he was very torn, let me just say before I answer your question, in the writing of this book about loving me, wanting to tell me, as he put it one time in the book, I love you very much and I want you to write a great book. I'm doing my best to tell you all I can. The moral evaluation of him is that it's difficult. On the one hand, by any objective standard, he has a completely different moral worldview than I do. He views the law essentially as a corrupt institution. And he views the government as a corrupt institution. He's not, doesn't much care about legal compliance. He's committed many, many crimes in his life. He wasn't a mobster, but because he wasn't a made man because he was half Irish, but he's very close to a lot of many members of organized crime. He has been his whole life, and he's done a lot in the service of those people and Hoffa in his criminal activities. So looked at from that point of view, you would say he doesn't do very well in the moral calculus, to put it mildly. And a lot of the dialogue in the book, several times I asked him, you're complaining about the government breaking the law, but what about all of your multiple serial law breaking, which you don't care about? And his basic view is, and it was a consistent view, his basic view is, they were coming after us and we had to do what we had to do to survive, and that's what I learned and that's what I believe. And that's a self-serving justification. There's truth to it, but it's a self-serving justification. So looked at from that perspective, I think anyone would have to say fails the morality test. I came, however, over the course of writing this book, we became extremely close. And I came to understand his worldview. It's a worldview born in necessity. It was what he was raised in. It's what he came to understand and value. And especially his Omerta commitment, which I started off thinking was just this self-serving, protective gambit of a guy who commits a lot of crimes to not talk about things he doesn't want to talk about. It wasn't that. It was a genuine commitment to principle. It was a principle that he admired and that ordered his life. And I have to say that at a certain point in the book, I came to admire it too. And I talk about this at the end in the following sense. At some point in the book, I didn't want him to tell me anymore. And I didn't want him to tell me anymore because I knew that if I pushed him too far, he would violate this principle of honor that was so central to him. And I didn't want to do that to him because he had this principle of honor was the thing he had held on to for 45 years, the thing he had suffered for 45 years out of commitment to. And so I describe it as the last conversation we had about this, when he basically said, "Sorry, son, I'm just not going to tell you what you want to know, everything you want to know." I described it. I said I was in awe of his eccentric integrity, and that's how I came to view it.
One of the other riveting features of this book, which is actually a subject about which I knew nothing, is the personality of Jimmy Hoffa, who I was kind of a kid when he disappeared, and I've always thought of him as a labor leader who was mostly mobster. You portray him in a much more complicated light, as kind of a labor pioneer in some ways who was, had complicated relationships with all kinds of different people. What is the legacy of Jimmy Hoffa?
Okay, I'm going to answer that. I forgot to answer one thing about the moral calculus of Chucky that I wanted to add, if I could, and then I'll talk about the legacy of Jimmy Hoffa. The other thing that I think is important in, if we're going to do a moral calculus, is two other things for me weighed in the scales. One, he was just an amazing father. And no matter what he did in his life, those 5 years he gave to me and the love he showed me for the last 15 were extraordinary, and I can never judge him too harshly because of that. That's the first thing. Second thing is, over the course of the last decade, or literally since I've worked in the government, I've really become much less judgmental for a whole bunch of reasons, in part because of my faith. But also, Chucky was right in the sense that, law-breaking is not something limited to criminals and mobsters. And there was a lot of compromise going on inside the government pursuing these folks. And it just muddied the waters for me just a little bit in terms of the moral calculus of law-breaking. Okay, Jimmy Hoffa's legacy. So I have to say, I spent a lot of time learning about this man. Chucky and I talked about him a long time. Chucky knew him better than anyone. I did a lot of research on this. And I came away, again, it's kind of, acknowledging that he broke every rule in the book, acknowledging that he was completely amoral and did not believe in the law. He was completely opportunistic. Everything for him was an instrumental exchange. What can you do for me, and what do I have to give you to do it? And he didn't care who he was dealing with. The mob for Hoffa was just another transaction. He had no fealty to the mob. It was just another transaction, he would do business with labor union leaders who had completely different ideologies. Hoffa was pretty conservative as a labor leader, and he would do business with people he despised because it would help his union. He would pay off politicians because it would help his union and help his power. So he was a lawbreaker, and he was completely amoral, and he didn't give a damn. On the other hand, I came to admire him enormously because, for so many reasons, he came from nothing. He was incredibly impressive at his job. He was an outstanding labor leader, setting aside all this stuff that got him in trouble that ended up being his fault, which you can't set aside. He was just a master at negotiation and bargaining and figuring out how to use transportation network of the Teamsters to grow the Teamsters legacy. No one has ever been, J. Edgar Hoover described what Bobby Kennedy did to Hoffa in a conversation with Richard Nixon as railroading. And that's a fair description. No one has ever been subjected to what Hoffa had been subjected to. So he was just an extraordinary man in many, many ways. And I try to paint a fairly rich picture of him. His legacy is complicated. I think it's mostly a tragic legacy. There was an opportunity for Jimmy Hoffa and the Teamsters in the 50s and 60s to lead the American labor movement in a completely different direction. At about the time that Hoffa was at his rise, the American labor movement was at its peak and was entering the period of its long decline to where it is today. Hoffa had the skills, and he had the Teamsters Union, which, because of its leverage over transportation networks, could have been a huge, powerful leverage of labor against management. And if the Teamsters had not been kicked out of the AFL and CIO for their corruption, it's just that labor might have gone in a completely different direction. Now, it's a completely fanciful hypothetical or counterfactual, because Hoffa was this bad guy. And even though he was a great labor leader and grew the Teamsters, and the Teamsters were growing massively, And his members loved him because he brought home the bacon. At the same time, he never could have led the labor movement because he was too corrupt. So the legacy there is a tragedy for the labor movement. The legacy of Bobby Kennedy taking Hoffa down is one that's very ironical, because Bobby Kennedy always thought if he decapitated Hoffa, that would get rid of mob control over the union. In fact, the opposite happened. As I show in the book, Hoffa actually kept the mob at bay. He gave them loans, but they were on his terms, and he kept them out as much as he could. And the opposite happened. When Kennedy decapitated Hoffa, the mob took over the Teamsters and basically just infiltrated it. So that's another legacy. And I think a lot of the legacy, I draw a tie between governmental abuses and overreach in the 50s and 60s to some things that are going on today. And I don't want to draw the analogy too sharply or too finely, but Hoffa stands with all of his sins as the person against whom the government had the most overreach. And it chastened me a little bit about that element of governmental power.
When you say that, are you including Martin Luther King in that, or is that a different category because it was sort of politically motivated and not really fundamentally about, you know, getting him for a crime?
What the government did to King was, I think, on any measure worse. Because actually, despite the just unbelievable illegal surveillance going on against King, not especially, but against the mob at the time, and I have a whole chapter on that, there are only a couple of instances that the government tried to hide hard what it did to Hoffa in terms of surveillance. I think it probably did surveil illegally a couple of times, but it was never surveilling Hoffa and using the evidence against him to try to basically blackmail him, get him to commit suicide. Nothing ever like that. That said, the government illegality against the mob in the 50s and 60s was far more extensive than ever against King. And what they did to Hoffa in the 50s and 60s was really abusive along many, many dimensions that might not rise to what they did to King, but in the aggregate was very, very bad.
All right, so we got to wrap up, but I want to, one of the things that I learned about Jimmy Hoffa in reading the book that just floored me was that the actual period of time that he was president of the Teamsters Union was really short. I mean, it's 1957 to 1964. 67, he goes to prison. So it's a 10-year period. And by the time he is president of the Teamsters Union, Bobby Kennedy already is obsessed with him.
Yeah.
And we continue to be obsessed with him in this weird way to this day.
Yeah.
And so my question, last, and just to wrap up, why is it that a guy who is for 10 years the president of the Teamsters Union and disappears in 1975 had such a hold on the public imagination that a presidential, ultimately a presidential candidate and his brother are obsessed with him? And 40 years after his death, we are still obsessed with him. Yep. Why do we care so much about Jimmy Hoffa?
I think the answer is two reasons. One, for those who were around in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, it's hard to exaggerate what a larger-than-life figure he was. He was an unbelievable presence and a spokesperson for labor, but also this defiant, strangely attractive, and abhorrent at the same time person who was caught up in this drama with the government over 10 decades, goes to prison in dramatic terms, comes out in dramatic terms, and then disappears. So Hoffa himself was a huge figure in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s. That's the backdrop. The second reason is simply because he just disappeared. We don't have, the truth is, no matter what anyone says, we don't know what happened to him. And he was seen in the parking lot, and then he just disappeared. And the truth is, nobody, I don't know what the government's evidence is, but nobody knows what happened to him. It's as if he just evaporated. And there's not a single piece of evidence, not one. And I've looked at it all and talked to everybody about what happened to him that afternoon and where and why he disappeared. We don't know if he got in a car voluntarily or if he was hit over the head. No one saw anything. And I think that given this larger-than-life figure who disappears completely under such dramatic circumstances and we just don't know what happened, it allows everyone to pour in their own backgrounds and theories. And you know, and this is why to this, you know, the book came out a week ago and people have come out of the woodwork. I've gotten about a dozen emails and calls saying, I know where Hoffa is. My cousin was involved. There's this farm outside of Detroit you should look at. Let me come talk to you about it. It's amazing the obsession that persists. But I think the reason is because Nobody knows what happened.
The book is In Hoffa's Shadow, A Stepfather, A Disappearance in Detroit, and My Search for the Truth. Please join me in thanking Jack Goldsmith.
Thank you for coming.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Jack Goldsmith and to the Texas Tribune Festival for hosting the event and providing this audio. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. You can purchase Lawfare t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more at thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patiahau, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.